So the first question I want to ask is, what inspired you to go to Russia and to engage in this trip?
In a word or a sentence, I believe that we are closer to nuclear war than we have ever been. I think that we are well beyond the maximum level of danger that we achieved during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that we were quite fortunate not to be obliterated in a nuclear war then, and that this is actually getting more dangerous by the day because each side is responding to the other side with one escalation after another. And to me, the number one priority right now for all persons of conscience is to find a way to de-escalate this conflict, and that means we have to engage in a dialogue with the enemy.
And what do you, what? Okay, so what is your overall goal for visiting Russia? Like, what did you aim to achieve in terms of what you wanted to learn, in terms of any messages you wanted to share? And can you tell me about what your vision was for how this would be a productive trip?
Okay, so let me start by acknowledging that I'm just one citizen, and I don't know whether I can contribute anything to a dialogue, but I happen to be in a fortunate situation where, I don't need to make a living. I have a considerable amount of expertise in international law and geopolitics, and I think I have skills at dispute resolution because that's what I did for 30 years as a lawyer. I mediated and negotiated the resolution of disputes. So I'm coming here with a view to trying to gain a better understanding of the Russian perspective. I don't think we're hearing enough about that in the West. I totally understand why people like you want the West to hear the Ukrainian perspective. I think it's absolutely critical that you do that job. But what the job that's not being done is, in my view, respectfully, is hearing from the other side to this conflict. And for us to have any chance at any kind of a negotiation that will resolve this dispute that is so dangerous to the future of our children, we have to hear from the other side. That's why I'm here. I'm here to hear from them and learn. I didn't come here to lecture people. There's lots of criticisms that I could direct at the Russian government. I've never been here before. I'm getting precious little information from my own media and my own politicians about the Russian perspective. I wanted to hear from them directly.
Okay, but there's two kinds of stakeholders you can engage with here, right? So you can think of it as state stakeholders and then everyday citizens. I mean, obviously that's an oversimplification, but if we want to use two broad categories. So what do you think state actors and their representatives can tell you in Russia that they haven't told other people already?
Well, first of all, it's not just state actors. In fact, I'm not talking principally to state actors. I have talked to a few. I'm talking principally to civil society and people in the street. That's what I'm really focused upon. And I don't see much of an attempt being made by the Western media and Western politicians to speak to them. And as far as, hearing from official Russia, I don't agree that we're getting that view. In fact, what happened as soon as this invasion began? We shut down RT and Sputnik. Basically, official Russian media were completely banned in the West. I think that was a mistake. That was a terrible mistake because at least they were giving us the Russian perspective. And I don't deny for one second that they, like Western media organizations, disseminate propaganda. But they do also convey the official perspective of the government. And we, as citizens of the West, need to have access to the perspectives of all governments that are involved in this conflict. So even when you're talking about officialdom, we are not hearing from them in the West nearly as much as we hear from the Ukrainian government and its Western sponsors. Not even close.
Okay, but the question here, if we're going to talk about the ethics of access to information, so one point is that could be argued that people still have access to this information. You can easily go and find Russia Today's content if you want to, and it's still widely available on Twitter and most social media. The second piece here is that considering that these outlets are often used to information which is propaganda and is actually untrue, in an effort to sway public opinion to the side, don't like Western states have a have an obligation to control their info space to some degree, to protect their citizens from misinformation.
I'm gonna try to respond to you in a respectful manner by taking you back to the lead up to the Iraq War. In the lead up to the Iraq War, which I think we should all be able to agree now was based on a pack of disgusting lies and resulted in the murder, the mass murder of hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis, there was almost universal support for the war in the Western media. So fanatical was that support that a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Chris Hedges, who was a New York Times war correspondent with a tremendous record, was actually terminated. He actually had to leave the New York Times because he was one of the few voices in the mainstream media that was arguing against this awful, evil war that caused so much suffering and destruction. The people that you say you're suggesting we should rely upon to protect us from misinformation are, and the historical record establishes this beyond a shadow of a doubt, some of the worst purveyors of disinformation in the history of propaganda. You think I'm going to trust the Canadian government and the U.S. government to tell me what is and is not true? I'm sorry. I don't think we should trust them. I don't trust the Russian government. I don't trust the Canadian government. What I do is I hear from all of them. I consult a variety of sources. Then I apply my own independent critical thinking, and I try to sort through what is true and what is false. And we as citizens in a supposedly democratic society, we should have the ability to make those judgments. If we don't have the ability to make those judgments, to discern disinformation from truth, then why do we give all people an equal right to vote? The premise of democracy is that we have the intellectual capacity to discern truth from falsehood. I do not trust the corporate media and Western governments to perform that function for me. I prefer to know all of the information and then decide for myself what's true and what's false. And I think I have trust in the citizenry to do that.
So is that a universalization? Do you believe that states should in general do nothing to combat foreign disinformation influence campaigns? Because doing so,
I didn't say that.
Because determining what is true and false.
No, I didn't say that.
I'm wondering, right? Because
Go ahead.
Okay, so you're basically, from my understanding, correct or wrong, is that from your perspective, the onus of discerning what is true and what's false and what is accurate and what's inaccurate should fall to everyday citizens, and that governments shouldn't intervene and try to filter out some material which may be seen as a disinformation or influence campaign.
Well, now you're saying something different. Okay, the first time you asked that question, you asked me whether I was saying that the government should do nothing. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the way you counter disinformation is with truth. That's how you counter it.
Okay.
So but that's not what our governments are doing. Our governments banned RT. They didn't set up a competing channel and say something like, RT says this. This is our response to what RT is saying. You can see RT. It's on our television. We're not going to do anything, to restrict your access to it. We're not going to make it harder for you to find it. But we're going to give you what we regard as the true version of events, and then let people decide. That's how you deal with disinformation, by debate. What we're doing in the West is we're silencing the other side. That I disagree with.
Speaking of someone who has reported from Ukraine for the past year, much of the material that RT has said has been just factually very, very, very untrue and doesn't really represent, the realities on the ground are. And, it can't be denied that this has a deeply political element to it. I mean, the Russian government has an agenda here. It's not trying to inform citizens of the truth. It's trying to, cloud their perception of things in a way that reduces their support, or their opposition to Russian interests. Okay, you want people to deal with this through debates.
May I just stop you there? I could say exactly the same thing about the West. I could say exactly the same thing. The number of lies that I have seen coming out of the Western media is appalling, absolutely appalling. For example, the Western media started claiming when the Russian government launched this invasion, it said, with total justification, We've been warning you for years that we would not put up with NATO expansion into Ukraine. We wanted to have a negotiation about that. You flatly refused to take that off the table. As soon as this war was launched, this tidal wave of bullshit started coming out of the Western media that this had nothing to do with NATO expansion. That is so ridiculously false. Anybody who looks at the historical record, going all the way back to the promise that was made to Gorbachev that NATO wouldn't expand eastward, going back to William Perry, the Clinton defense secretary, threatening to resign because Clinton broke that promise. William Kennan, one of the leading foreign policy figures in the West in the 1990s, was warning that the expansion of NATO was a catastrophic mistake. William Burns, the current CIA director, when he was in Russia, before he was the CIA director, sent a cable back to the State Department that was leaked by WikiLeaks, in which he said that across the political spectrum in Russia, it wasn't just Putin, it was his liberal opponents. There was universal opposition to NATO expansion. And we're supposed to believe that NATO expansion had nothing to do with this. That's the lie we've been told by the Western media from day one. And I could go on and on. I could go on and on. Like, you know, another claim that's total bullshit is that there wasn't a coup in 2014. We have a recording of Victoria Nuland, Adam. Victoria Nuland, a senior State Department person, speaking to the ambassador of Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, telling him who the next prime minister of Ukraine is going to be before Yanukovych was overthrown. It was Yatsenyuk. And sure enough, Yatsenyuk became the prime minister. Stratfor, which is a geopolitical analysis firm that's closely tied to the U.S. government, its CEO said that this was the most blatant coup in history. And as soon as the invasion was launched, we started hearing from the Western media, oh, there was no coup. That was just Russian propaganda. So I could make exactly the same arguments about the Western media. They've been lying through their teeth. You guys are, I'm sorry to say this, Adam, you guys are not pure as the driven snow. There is a tidal wave of propaganda coming out of both sides.
I mean, look, no one that I've spoken to who is a Ukraine expert has taken the coup thesis with any seriousness.
Who? What Ukraine expert? You think John Mearsheimer isn't a Ukraine expert? You think Nikolai Petro isn't a Ukraine expert?
I've seen, for example, like the sources that you cite, was it Katinsky? There's that one, you know, U of Ottawa professor who's an absolute outlier in this space.
No, he's not.
And
no, he's not.
Snipers and Python has been pretty soundly, you know, condemned by others who work in this field. So there's a little bit, you know, questioned here about, in terms of like the sort of critical analysis that you're, you know, applying to some of your sources here.
Okay, let me give you another example. I don't agree with anything you've just said, okay? You guys in the Western media have been claiming there isn't a serious problem with neo-Nazism in Ukraine. In December 2018, the Ukrainian parliament declared a national holiday for Stepan Bandera, a genocidal anti-Semite whose organization was responsible for the mass murder of tens of thousands of Poles, Jews, and Russians. This was the Ukrainian parliament. And even this year, on January 1st, during the middle of this war, the Polish government came out, one of the most fanatical supporters of Ukraine, and bitterly condemned the Ukrainian government for celebrating the birthday or the legacy of Stepan Bandera on January 1st. And you guys are telling us there isn't a serious problem with neo-Nazism in Ukraine? Are you serious?
Yes, there is no problem. Yes, there is no serious problem.
That's not what I've been hearing.
Someone who was reported on here for the past year. So first of all, the whole thing with Bandera, he's acknowledged to be a controversial figure.
No, he's and not a controversial figure, Adam. He is a genocidal the fact that you use that phrase to describe him shows exactly my point. You're whitewashing this man. Go read what the Polish government said when on January 1st they had another torchlight march for Stepan Bandera. The Polish government, go read what they said, and then you tell me if this guy's just a controversial figure.
Okay, Dmitry, so let me say a few things here. So if you want to talk about Stepan Bandera, I would say personally that he's comparable in terms of having a mixed legacy to, let's say, Mao. You know, Mao Zedong was a horrific butcher whose policies directly led to the deaths of millions of people, you know, through his horrific mismanagement as well as through his political persecution of his opponents. So I think that Mao is a horrible human being, and many people feel similarly. There are also many people who venerate Mao because of his role in fighting colonialism, in establishing China's sovereignty, and they recognize that there is a mixed legacy here as well. There are people who can be monsters, but can at the same time have multiple different meanings to different people. And no one who I've engaged with in Ukraine has ever celebrated Stepan Bandera's horrific actions, like with respect to Poles and with respect to Jews. And any person who you speak to about Bandera acknowledges the fact that he did horrific things. And they try to call attention to the fact that, yes, he did horrific things, but then you're also dealing with a complicated region where different forms of colonial resistance can sometimes take very ugly forms. Now, when it comes to scholarship about Ukrainian nationalism, the overall thing that's acknowledged is that Stepan Bandera was considered a fairly minor figure until he was elevated by the Russians and turned some sort of, you know, big, like, turned some sort of, like, almost celebrity. The Ukrainians...
Oh, so you're blaming the Russians for the fact that the Ukrainian parliament declared a national holiday for this man? You think that's the Russians' fault?
He's considered to be one of many different historical figures.
Yeah, but it's the Ukrainian parliament that elevated him to a national hero, Adam. It wasn't the Russians who did that. Did the Russians ask the Ukrainian parliament to declare a national holiday for Stepan Bandera? It's the Ukrainian parliament that elevated this man to a national hero. It's not the Russians. The Russians have been condemning him bitterly from day one.
Look... So insofar as he's celebrated for his attempts to establish some sort of Ukrainian sovereignty. And no one that I've ever engaged with in Ukraine has ever condoned his massacres or ever condoned his anti-Semitism. Now, his relevance in political discourse here is fairly marginal. You know, no one talks about Stepan Bandera unless he's brought up about the Russians' attempts to paint everyone as a Banderite. In fact, local Ukrainians joke, oh, we may as well just, you know, cut out his face and tape it over our faces, since that's apparently all the Russians see. The idea that Russians think that everyone in Ukraine is a Banderite. But let's talk more about...
And by the way, I don't agree with that. I don't think that everyone in Ukraine is a Banderite. But again, I cannot stress this enough, Adam. This is a serious matter. This isn't just, you know, you say Ukrainians, nobody thinks this or that about Stepan Bandera. They declared a national holiday for the man. Okay, that's and by the way, whatever the people, if I may, whatever the people you're talking to in Ukraine may say about that behind the scenes, what I'm saying to you is, if I'm a Russian and I see Ukraine's parliament declaring a national holiday for this man, I'm going to become alarmed. I'm going to become alarmed. Okay. And that alarm is real. It's genuine. Whatever you're hearing from people, and we should be trying to understand that. We should understand, how are the Russians, who suffered 27 million dead, the Soviet Union and the Russians in particular, suffered more dead than all of the Allied powers, including Germany, the mass murderers themselves suffered a fraction of the casualties of the Russians at the hands of Nazism. Okay. So when the Russians hear this, they are alarmed, and understandably so, and we're not really making any effort, in my view, to appreciate why they're having this reaction.
Okay, so two main things. So first thing I'm gonna ask is that if we're gonna use another comparative case, let's look at John A. McDonald, also a man with a very mixed history, and is celebrated for many good things, but also is responsible for atrocious crimes against indigenous people. You know, the fact that we celebrate John A. McDonald in our country, does that make us a genocidal state?
Yes, absolutely.
Does that mean that Canadians by and large support genocide?
There is a tremendous tolerance in our country for genocide. There is genocide going on right now. Right now, there's genocide. The Canadian government is contemplating the release of massive amounts of toxic tailings into the Athabasca River, which would have absolutely catastrophic consequences for Indigenous peoples living up there. Something in excess of 30% of the people in our correctional facilities are Indigenous, even though they only constitute 4% of the population. There is the genocide never ended. It's ongoing. It's just a low-level genocide now. And the fact that our country disgustingly honors Sir John A. Macdonald, whom I have condemned repeatedly, I think it's appalling that we treat that man as a national hero. I think that that says a lot about our country's moral character. I'm deeply troubled as a Canadian about all of that. And I think there's a connection between what we're doing today to Indigenous peoples, which is a low-level continuation of a genocide, and are continuing to honor that racist, genocidal person, Sir John A. Macdonald, who should be erased from any discussions about what is good about Canada.
Okay, well, another comparative example, let's say Che Guevara. I mean, I think I saw from some of your posts that you are a fan of his. Does that mean that you condone his homophobic policies and
no.
his...
He was okay. Well, I'm not even, to be honest with you, I'm not even aware of that. This is the first time hearing about it. And now that you're telling me that, I've never heard that before. I will investigate that, and I may very well have to revise my opinions about Che Guevara. I didn't know that he had homophobic policies.
Oh, okay, because you know he's been criticized as a racist, a homophobe, and a mass murderer.
Well, I've never heard any of that.
You know,
I've never heard any of that.
Okay. But let's say those things are true. You know, so one person might say, okay, you can still respect him for the things that you perceive that he did well, while at the same time simultaneously acknowledging that he did horrific things too. You know,
I wouldn't declare no. Now, if what you're saying about him is true, that he's a homophobe and he was a mass murderer and a racist, which shocks me that you're saying this, because I've never heard any of that before. But let's suppose it's true, okay? I'd be the last person to say that we should be honoring this man. I will renounce that man and condemn him without any hesitation.
Oh, okay. So I think there's a fundamental disagreement in terms of how we evaluate people morally. You know, you say there are many people are willing to admit that people can have mixed moral legacies and that you can simultaneously celebrate the positive aspects of someone's legacy without endorsing the negative aspects.
Yeah, but Adam, what I'm saying to you is even if you're right,
right.
Really, I don't think you're appreciating my main point. My main point is even if you're right, I don't agree with you about this. I think if somebody has done the kinds of things that Stepan Bandera has done or Sir John A. Macdonald has done or what you're saying that Che Guevara did, I don't think we should honor them at all. Okay? But let's suppose you're right.
Okay.
Let's suppose you're right. It doesn't relieve us of the obligation to understand the impact that this is having on other people, our enemies. We still have an obligation, mm-hmm. especially if we are seriously, I can't stress enough, I have to go back to what I said at the very outset of this conversation about the risk of nuclear war. If we're serious about avoiding a nuclear war, which any sane person should be, we have to be sensitive to how doing that is affecting the side that has enough nukes to destroy the world many times over. That's how sane, rational, humane people behave. They don't just say, oh, well, this person did some good things, therefore I'm going to honor them. What they also do is they say, how is this affecting the other side, my enemy? How are they perceiving this? And we're not doing that. We're not honestly asking ourselves how the glorification of Stepan Bandera is affecting the Russian view of this conflict and of Ukraine.
Okay, well, so just pushing back on the Nazi piece, so, I mean, it's just kind of objectively a fact that Nazism isn't a huge issue in Ukraine. And you can look at that in a few different ways. The first way is looking at polling data. I mean, that seems to be the most effective way to gauge people's political views. The far right has never gotten more than 5% in any election since 2014, right? So if the far right were as pervasive and as influential as, you know, the Russians and their friends like to make it out to be, then you would see that reflected in the way that people vote, but you simply don't. You know,
I've heard this argument many times. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just flatly disagree. Because, you know, the far right in Ukraine, you cannot measure its power and its influence purely by reference to the ballot box. You have to also take into account the fact that it is heavily armed. It has infiltrated the institutions of the state to a significant degree, and it has basically committed atrocities with impunity for 9 years, like burning alive dozens of pro-Russian activists in the trade union building in Odessa back in 2014, like blowing up the electrical infrastructure in Kherson that was providing the majority of the electricity to Crimea after the referendum. Okay, and it got away with it.
I mean, so as someone who lives in Odessa, I mean, your characterization of what happened in Odessa in 2014 is not accurate.
According to who? Did you speak to the victims of the families of the victims?
No, did you interview them? People who were alive at the time. We were very familiar with these protests.
So you didn't speak to the families of the victims, the people who actually were burned to death.
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, I think you may want to talk to them before you. I've watched videos of this, and beyond horrific, okay. And based on what I've seen, and accounts from people who were there at the time, people who lost friends and family, videotaped interviews. That is exactly what happened. But you know I think you should investigate that further. There's no doubt, however, I don't think you can reasonably dispute the fact that the far right in Ukraine is heavily armed, and they have gotten away with atrocities. And, you know, we have a far right in Canada, but our far right in Canada doesn't openly run around, you know, with, you know, automatic weapons, you know, marching in the streets and, you know, and basically telling the President Zelensky, when he made a feeble effort back in 2019 to reduce tensions in the Donbass, you know, to hell with you. We're not putting up with that. We don't want peace with the Donbass. We're not going to deal with the Minsk Accords. We don't want them to have any degree of autonomy. We want the Russian culture to be stamped out. That's what they told him. He capitulated. The man probably feared for his life, and I wouldn't blame him.
So I've interviewed LGBTQ leaders and Jewish leaders in Ukraine, people who are traditionally victims of Nazism and the far right, and LGBTQ leaders from across Ukraine have vocally and enthusiastically condemned this narrative as being just propaganda. Similarly, Jewish leaders in Odessa have also condemned this as just propaganda. So are the Jews of Ukraine and the LGBTQ people of Ukraine misguided? Are they lying? Are they just simply unaware of all this Nazism which is around them? Do the Nazis in Ukraine just somehow love Jews and LGBTQ people? Can you clarify that contradiction for me?
Why don't you show me the statements? Show me the statements. I want to see exactly who said what. I'm not going to sit there and take your word for it. Sorry, I'm not. I'm not aware of these statements. I will take them into account, and I will show you statements from members of the Jewish community who are appalled about what's happening in Ukraine and the tolerance for the far right.
Okay, I mean, I'm happy to introduce you to Kyiv Pride, Odessa Pride, Kharkiv Pride. Happy to introduce you to any sort of LGBTQ person who lives here, who's never really had any issues with the far rights.
I don't know. I mean, in this conversation, I never said that the far right was targeting the LGBTQ community. You didn't hear me say that, did you? Okay, I'm talking about how Russians perceive Russians, because they're the enemy. They're the ones with whom we are in an existentially dangerous conflict. How they perceive the glorification of Stepan Bandera and the relative impunity with which far right groups commit acts of violence in Ukraine. Oh, that's what I'm talking about. I wasn't talking to you about how the LGBT community feels about that. And I'm happy to hear that they don't feel threatened by those people. But I believe the Russians do.
Well, I mean, you know, if we're trying to talk about what the truth is of the political situation in Ukraine, I think how minority groups, what they think about Nazism and the far right is highly relevant. And I think that...
It's relevant, you know, but it's not dispositive. It's not dispositive. You know, the problem we have here, Adam, is that we have... this whole discussion about neo-Nazism in Ukraine, we don't have a consensus on what we mean about Nazism. That's a problem. Okay,
what I'll say is that, you know, if there's a giant problem with Nazism that somehow hasn't been reflected in votes, you know, these Nazis have less than 5% of the votes. They are somehow, you know, incredibly important, incredibly influential, incredibly powerful, but somehow get less than 5% of the vote and somehow are unnoticed by LGBTQ and Jewish leaders who, you know, completely claim that they don't exist. Well, these seem like somewhat magical Nazis, you know,
who are unnoticed by LGBTQ. I'm sorry, no. Look, man, you know, first of all, you're assuming that the people who actually get the majority of the votes, that they're somehow, you know, progressive, or they're, you know, anti-Nazi. The parliament, I cannot stress this enough, you're making it sound like the far right is some little, you know, insignificant force because they get some percentage of the vote. I would suggest to you, Adam, that anybody who thinks it appropriate to declare a national holiday for the likes of Stepan Bandera is the far right. That is the far right. Nobody who isn't on the far right would vote for Stepan Bandera to be glorified. Okay? So I don't know who it is you're calling far right. I would ask you to reconsider how you define the far right, because evidently you're excluding from your definition of the far right people who supported the glorification of Stepan Bandera in Ukraine's parliament.
You know, what I'm saying is that there are people who are Nazis and who are on the far right who, you know, will, of course, glorify Stepan Bandera, considering his crimes in the past that were anti-Semitic and anti-Polish. So those kinds of people are supporting Stepan Bandera because of the horrific things that he did. There are also other people who are not on the far right who condemn Bandera for the horrible things that he did, while at the same time having mixed feelings given his attempts to help with Ukrainian sovereignty. In Eastern Europe and in Southeastern Europe, you know, things are not clear-cut in terms of people's moral legacies. I say this as someone who is from the Balkans and am very familiar with the fact that there are many, many, many figures that have very, very complicated moral legacies, and coming in and trying to reduce everything to just black and white as an outsider doesn't really work well. You know, I'm asking you to consider the fact that things are not as black and white, and you need to understand the complexity of history, and that just because someone celebrates some of the positive aspects of someone's history doesn't mean that they endorse or in any way support the negative aspects.
I'm also from the Balkans, Adam, and I don't agree that, as I've indicated, and I gave the example of Sir John A. Macdonald.
I don't agree
with that. But let me just say one thing here, because I find it quite ironic that you're giving me this speech about complexity. I read your article. You wrote an article back on February 23rd, I believe it was, in which you imagined what would have happened if Russia had won this war in the first few weeks of the conflict. What I saw in that article, with all due respect, is what I call the Star Wars view of the world. And the Star Wars view of the world is that we in the West and our Ukrainian allies, we are Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Vladimir Putin is Darth Vader. And I'm surprised to hear you talking to me about the complexity of this world. I wonder whether you apply that same philosophy and that same sense of nuance and sophistication when you think about the Russian people. Do you only apply it when you think about the Ukrainians and their glorification of Stepan Bandera? Or do you also apply that nuance to the Russians? I'd ask you to think about that.
Sure. I mean, so when it comes to the Russians, I understand that there's a certain degree of, I don't want to say colonial trauma, but like a sense of loss of empire, which impacts the way that they perceive the world. You have a nation that historically has been powerful, influential, has been the king of its region. You have an empire that's been short of its imperial property. And you had a very, very traumatic decade in the 1990s that Russians have tried very hard to forget. And I think many Western commentators are unfamiliar of why Putin was, they don't understand why Putin was so popular for the first 12 or so years of his rule, because there was that attempt to provide stability and to regain dignity for the Russians for the first 12 or so years. And you saw an 800% increase in GDP in Russia, and people were happy for a bit. But then you had a new middle class that wanted more and was less complacent with the corruption of Putin's regime, and less complacent with the compromises they had in civil liberties, and wanted freer elections. And so you had the anti-Putin like sort of protests that happened from 2011 to 2012, I believe, or 2012 or 2013. And that was something which was disturbing to Putin. And so he managed to repress that, and then he found he needed to find an alternative way to secure his regime legitimacy. And so that's why we see coming from around 2013, a shift in overall tone in foreign policy becomes more belligerent. You see the rise of traditional values politics, So an attempt to create a kind of social conservatism in opposition to North American liberalism. You see the invasion of Eastern Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea as a way to shore up his regime legitimacy. And you just see kind of like a more nationalistic and jingoistic country. And, you know, I understand that's a rational position for someone who wants to maintain power. And I know that that plays well with some Russians. For those who didn't want that and who wanted a more liberal and pluralistic society, they tried to protest, and unfortunately that didn't work. I've interviewed about 6 different dissident Russians, and they speak with a great sense of sadness about how they've been unable to express themselves politically since about 2013, 2012. So I'm familiar with, you know, the factors that come into play here.
I disagree with about 80% of what you just said. You started that sort of long exposition on your view about Russia today with me asking you whether or not you apply to the Russian people and Russian society the same level of nuance and sensitive, complex understanding and analysis which you say we ought to apply to Ukraine. That's where this started. I didn't hear anything in there at all which suggested that that's what you do. So you told me you interviewed 6 dissidents. This is part of the problem. Of course we should hear from dissidents. Of course we should hear from Russia dissidents. I'm glad that we hear from Russia dissidents. But the fact of the matter is that a majority of the Russian people up till this very day, you talked about like 2012 or 13, Levada, which is a reputable polling agency, shows that Putin's current approval rating is around 80%. It shows that it never fell below 60%. And this narrative that he was somehow, you know, his popularity was on the rocks. I mean, and he had to do something desperate like seize Crimea. It just doesn't accord with the polling numbers. His polling numbers have been consistently higher throughout the time he's been president than the vast majority of Western leaders. And so that's the first thing. So when I say to you and I suggest to you that you take a nuanced view of Russian society, what I'm saying to you is that you shouldn't confine yourself to dissidents. You should speak to the people who are in the majority, who actually support Putin. That's what I'm doing. And those are the people we never hear from. We hear from Pussy Riot. You know, we hear from Alex Navalny. And great, I'm glad we hear from those people. But we never hear from the many millions of Russians who support Putin and try to understand why. And most people do continue to support him.
Okay.
So that's where there's okay, a... you went on for quite some time. There's a couple other things I want to say. Okay. You talked about...
Okay.
You started out by saying, you know, oh, I feel sorry for Russia because it was this great empire and so forth. Like, I regard that as really... That's kind of a way of giving somebody a slap with the back of your hand. It's a backhanded compliment. You know, you're really slapping them down rather than acknowledging something good about the people. If you were actually being nuanced, I think the way you would approach your analysis here, because it's absolutely fundamental to what's going on, is by pointing out or taking into account what I've tried to stress was that the Russian people suffered a historical trauma within the lifetimes of some Russians alive today and within the last century that we can't even begin to comprehend in Canada or in the United States. What happened to them in World War II was beyond horrific. It was something that is outside of our national experience. And if you really want to understand the Russian mentality right now, you have to take that into account. And I didn't hear anything about that. I even raised it with you, and in your exposition of how you feel you're being nuanced in your analysis of Russians, you said nothing about this unbelievable historical trauma that they suffered. And how do they feel when they see German Leopard tanks next to their border a few hundred kilometers from Moscow? How do you think they feel about that? How do you think they feel when they see Poles and Banderites, because there are Banderites in the military of Ukraine, killing Russians after that historical trauma? We can't really understand the power and the passion of their reaction to what's going on in Ukraine without taking that into account. And that's just one example of ways in which we fail to make a genuine effort on our side to hear what they're saying to us. And if we don't make that genuine effort, Adam, ultimately at the end of the day, you and I can debate this till the cows come home. What's going to happen is that this thing's going to continue to escalate in the best case scenario. And of course, this isn't a good case scenario at all. It's a horror show. Ukraine will be destroyed. That's where we're heading. In the worst case scenario, we are all dead in a nuclear war. If we don't actually find a way to talk to the Russian people, that's where we're heading.
I have a question. Would you apply this kind of understanding to Americans when they were engaging in their own imperialistic conflicts? So, for example, would you say, oh, well, we need to understand Americans and their misperceptions of the Middle East during the 2000s, right? We need to understand the trauma, like, you know, if when the United States invaded Iraq, was the most important thing to condemn this invasion or to ask ourselves, well, you know, like maybe the Americans are justified in feeling in doing this because they feel, you know, they have these certain negative perceptions about the Middle East. And, you know, does it really matter if those negative perceptions are true so long as like that's what, so long as the Americans believe it, that we have to really consider about, you know, their trauma of 9/11 rather than actually focusing on the real victims here, which is the Iraqi people. Like what I'm seeing here is like, you know, you care so much about what the Russians might think about Leopard tanks being in Ukraine, not even on Russian land. And it strikes me as very strange, and a little bit like it's bizarre, right? I'm here in Ukraine visiting. Well, I was, now I'm in Belgrade, but I was visiting, you know, towns that were completely destroyed. You know, people who are worried about their cities just being snuffed out of existence, people whose families have died, people who have to walk over corpses. And your primary concern is, do Russians feel offended by the, you know, presence of Leopard tanks on Ukrainian land to defend Ukrainian lives and sovereignty?
No, I mean, you're totally mischaracterizing my position. I mean, it's shocking, really. As I've said from the very outset, my primary concern is that people are being killed and we could all end up dead. That's my primary concern. And what I'm saying to you is, if you don't find a way to talk to Russians, that's what's going to happen. We're going to all end up dead. At a bare minimum, Ukraine will be destroyed. That's my primary concern, Adam. And I'm trying to find a way to stop that from happening. So for you to suggest that I'm not concerned about the bodies on the ground is really just intellectually dishonest, to be perfectly blunt about it. And frankly, so too is comparing the U.S. invasion of Iraq to what's going on in Ukraine. There is absolutely no comparison. You're going to tell me that the historical trauma of 9/11, of, you know, as horrible as it was, 3,500 people, is comparable to losing 27 million people and seeing entire cities laid waste, you know, like Stalingrad? And Sebastopol was obliterated. Sebastopol, where I am today, was completely obliterated by the Nazis. So first of all, the trauma that you, America, experienced, as terrible as it was on 9/11, is not remotely comparable to that the Russians suffered during the Second World War. Secondly, this is happening on Russia's border, a few hundred miles from Moscow. Iraq was halfway across the world. Thirdly, the American intelligence itself, there were American intelligence sources itself saying at the time that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Western intelligence agencies knew this to be the case. Okay? Whereas in this case, it is in fact true that Ukrainian military forces have been bombarding Donetsk and that thousands of civilians have been killed. It's not a lie. That is true. And it's true that the Russians have killed Ukrainian civilians. But the point here is that no one's hands are clean in this conflict, and it's not remotely comparable to what the United States did in Iraq. Not even close.
Are you familiar with like Russia's overall imperial sensibilities, imperial perspective on Eastern Europe, this idea that Eastern Europeans need in some sense to be reabsorbed into Russia? For example, there's that long essay that Putin published in the summer of 2021, basically arguing that Ukrainian nationhood is a fabrication and that Ukrainians aren't a distinct people, but rather are wayward Russians who were misled into believing that they have a separate culture and a separate nation based on Soviet policies.
Okay, well, I've read the article, and I think you're mischaracterizing the article, first of all. And this is something that's done systematically with respect to what Putin says. Secondly, you did a little sleight of hand there. Okay, you went from talking about Eastern Europe, and then you started talking about an essay about Ukraine. So what are we talking about here? Because there's an argument being made, and you made it yourself, I believe, in your February 2023 piece, that if Ukraine had fallen, then Russia was going to go barreling into Eastern Europe. Okay, so let's just make sure what we're talking about here. Are we talking about Russia's view of Ukraine, or are we talking about Russia's view about Poland? Because those are two different questions.
They're distinct, but they're interrelated, right? So when you have a political leader who says that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was one of the greatest geopolitical disasters of the 20th century, and you have this sort of rhetoric that talks about protecting quote-unquote Russian minorities in the Baltics.
Yeah, he went on to say, and you're leaving out something like very important. He went on to say that anybody who tries to, who thinks that we should reconstruct the Soviet Union is basically an imbecile. That's never mentioned. In the same speech, that's what he said. And when he was really talking about, in my opinion, when he was talking about the tragedy of the demise of the Soviet Union, I think it's quite clear from what he, from the totality of his speeches and what he was saying in that speech, you're picking out a snippet and mischaracterizing it. He was talking about the Russians who got stranded in countries that were no longer part of the Soviet Union, principally Ukraine. Okay? These people had a closer bond to Russia culturally, linguistically, than they did to the countries in which they were left when the Soviet Union fell apart. And he was saying that that's a tragedy. I don't think he was saying, in fact, I don't know how you could interpret his speech when he says that anybody who thinks that we should reconstruct the Soviet Union is brain dead. I don't know how you could interpret that to be a call to the reconstruction of the Soviet Empire.
What I would say is that when you have Eastern European leaders who are deeply alarmed about Russian foreign policy and have been saying for 15 years at least that this kind of expansionism would occur,
who's saying that?
Well, for example, well, Polish officials have been predicting Russian expansionism since approximately 2006 accurately predicted that increased oil and gas pipelines would eventually be used to facilitate Russian expansionism in Ukraine and then into the Baltics and then into Poland.
I don't think they accurately predicted that at all. I'm sorry, like you're saying stuff that I just don't agree with. They did that's just not true. That the pipeline somehow facilitated expansion into Ukraine and Poland? What? I don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, not into Poland. Sorry, that the pipeline was a precursor to an expansion into Ukraine.
I think that's nonsense. The whole reason why I just don't agree with your premise, Adam, the whole reason why I think they wanted to construct Nord Stream was so that they wouldn't have to put, wouldn't have to deal with the headache of their pipelines being under the jurisdiction of Ukraine. They didn't try to use pipelines in order to get control of Ukraine. They tried to, in fact, avoid having to run their pipelines through Ukraine. And through Poland.
So the argument which was made by Polish officials in the late 2000s and was then later echoed by other Eastern European leaders was that by bypassing Eastern European countries when it comes to gas pipelines, that would make it easier for Russia to engage in expansionary wars in the region without having to worry about risking energy, without jeopardizing his energy exports. So that turned out to be true.
No, it didn't. Adam, the exact opposite turned out to be true. When Russia invaded, they shut down Nord Stream. I can't believe you're saying this. They actually cut off Nord Stream. It gave the Americans the perfect pretext to sever the relationship, and which is exactly why the Americans had a motive to provoke a war. They were trying for years to pressure the Germans into killing Nord Stream. They were trying for decades, in fact, to sever the natural resources relationship between Russia and Europe. They wanted to weaken Russia, they wanted to weaken Europe, and they wanted to increase Europe's dependence on American oil. The invasion gave them exactly the pretext that they needed. Biden even said
in a press conference before the invasion, if Russia invades, we will bring an end to Nord Stream. And by the way, that's exactly what he did. So how anybody can say that this all worked out to, you know, this is exactly the plan that the Russians had in mind and it worked like a charm. I mean, it is exactly the opposite of what happened. It destroyed Russia's energy relationship with Europe.
That was their plan. Unfortunately, it didn't work because there was an unexpected level of unity within the West. And on top of that, Ukraine was able to more resistance than many people expected.
When they took Crimea, Adam, they were pummeled with sanctions. How could they not have foreseen this was going to happen? Of course they foresaw this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. You think that the Russian government didn't realize that it wasn't sitting there thinking for months before it launched this invasion, man, they're going to probably shut down Nord Stream if we do this. Of course they knew this was going to happen, Adam. I mean, they understood exactly. I think that this is one of the reasons why they waited so long, because they knew that the sanctions were going to come down on them like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, I mean, they knew that Nord Stream would be a powerful instrument for them to pressure Europe, and they engaged in that energy blackmail over the past year, and unfortunately, it didn't work.
The United States engaged in energy blackmail. It was the United States that engaged in energy blackmail. The United States said to Russia, "We're going to shut down Nord Stream if you do this." It was the United States that used energy as a blackmail, and they did it openly. And you're accusing Russia of engaging in energy blackmail. This is one of the things about the Western narrative that I just find absolutely mind-boggling. Like, somehow in the Western narrative, we managed to turn reality on its head.
Okay, so is it your stance that Russia is not engaging in energy blackmail?
No, I think Putin has said repeatedly, if you want the oil, turn on Nord Stream 2. And, you know, that's why the Americans destroyed it, Adam. They destroyed it because the Americans didn't want that to happen. They didn't want Russia to reestablish an energy relationship with Germany. And so they blew it up. And it's obvious that they blew it up. So to say when the Americans go and they blow up Nord Stream and they threaten to destroy Nord Stream and bring it to an end, that it's the Russians who are engaging in energy blackmail, I just find that remarkable. I mean, how could you come to that conclusion with all of the facts?
Okay, let's circle back to your trip. So my question to you is, do you believe that civil society actors and everyday citizens are giving you their actual opinions on the war? Or the situations on the ground?
I think that's a very good question. I think that's a very good question, and I'm still gathering information, I'm still speaking to people. I have to weigh it up. I have to reflect upon it. For the time being, what I'm doing is I'm reporting what I'm hearing. But I readily acknowledge that I may not be getting the truth from some people. Who knows? Maybe nobody's giving me the truth. But I'll tell you that my initial impressions are that, for the most part, people are being quite candid with me. So, for example, I've heard quite a bit of criticism of Vladimir Putin. But the criticism is not the criticism you're hearing from the West. The criticism I'm hearing is that, why did Putin wait so long to do this? Why is Putin being so restrained? I've heard that over and over again. Mm-hmm. So people, it's not like people are afraid to criticize Vladimir Putin. Okay. They're just articulating different criticisms from the one you're hearing in the West.
Okay. You are aware that criticism of the war is illegal in Russia, right?
Yes, I am. Well, I think essentially that's true. I commented on this in an article. I don't know if you read it. It's called 10 Days to Moscow. And I quoted at length Fred Weir, he's a correspondent for Christian Science Monitor. He's been here since the 1980s. He's written a number of articles. I actually met with him and I talked with him for 2 hours. He's been intensely critical of the repression of free speech. And there's no doubt that that's a serious issue in this country. And it's something that one has to take into account when one, you know, tries to engage in dialogue with Russians. One has to ask, how free do they feel about expressing their opinions? That's a serious issue.
Okay, so I have a question. If you're looking to get the Russian perspective, so have you interviewed Russians who are living abroad, Russians who left because of mobilization, Russians who left at the beginning of the war? How are you holistically getting a Russian perspective? or are you trying to holistically get the Russian perspective?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was well aware, I mean, Fred Weir has spent most of his life here. He's married to a Russian woman, and they have a child to get together, who, by the way, went to Ottawa to study and wants to come home to Russia because he had an experience with the medical care system in Canada, which really discouraged him. And so their son wants to come, even though he's absolutely fluent in English. So it was quite an interesting, enlightening conversation. But when I went to speak to Fred, I expected to hear a lot of criticism about Russia. I've also reached out myself to Boris Kargalitsky, who is, I mean, I don't know if you saw his recent article in Canadian Dimension. He's a Russian Marxist. This man, I mean, you couldn't be more critical from a left-wing perspective about the Russian government than Boris Kargalitsky. He actually was saying, I hope that Ukraine defeats Russia. It'll be the best thing for Russia. He put this in writing in the current political climate. So he's another person I've reached out to. There are a couple of other leftists who are very critical of Russia that I'm arranging to meet in Moscow. But I absolutely want to hear from them. But I do want to say this, Adam. It's very important. You know, all we get in the West is criticism of Russia. And if I came here and I focused on criticism of Russia, of the government, I don't think I really would be accomplishing much because that's all I get 24/7 living in Canada. Unrelenting criticism of Russia's government. What I want to understand is what we're not being told, which is why do so many people support the Russian government? Why are so many Russians supportive of this war effort? That's the question that's unanswered. I have a pretty good sense from the Western media about why there are people who in Russia or who've left Russia and who are very critical about Vladimir Putin.
I mean, you know, I can give a bit of response when it comes to Donetsk and Luhansk in terms of what some people believe, because I have interviewed people who have family in these areas. And, you know, you're probably going to roll your eyes, but a lot of it comes down to propaganda. For example, one of my interviewees is a Donetsk. He's a native of Donbass. His family is from Donbass. And he moved to Kyiv in 2014 and lived all around Ukraine. You know, Russian speaker from Donbass, had family back home, and his family only consumed Russian media. And they were convinced that Ukraine was run by Nazis and that Russian speakers were being persecuted all throughout the country. And he would try to tell them, I am your son. I am a Russian speaker. I am from Donbass. I have been all throughout Ukraine and I haven't seen any Nazis and I haven't seen any persecution of Russian speakers. And they refused to believe him. And this is something which is quite common in Ukraine, where, you know, there are those familial ties. So you can get some sense of what people believe through their families, where Ukrainians consistently have family members who are living in Russia who simply refuse to believe what these Ukrainians are saying about their own country. Ukrainians saying, no, like, I'm a Russian speaker and I don't find there to be any Russian persecution. No, I don't find there to be any sort of issue with Nazism. And their family members simply refuse to believe them. And it's a testament to the to just how tightly controlled their infosphere is and how pervasive that propaganda is. Like, you know,
okay, so Adam, I've spoken to people too who have been to Donetsk and Luhansk and who have family there. I don't think that they were imagining that their family members were killed. I don't think they were convinced that they are dead because of Russian propaganda. Okay, so I understand there's a perspective out there. You've heard it. I can't question that perspective. I've not spoken to these people, but I can tell you that there's another perspective. Okay, there are a lot of people from that region and who have family members from that region who are absolutely convinced that the Ukrainian military is bombarding Donetsk. There's lots of video evidence to back this up. There has been for some 8 years. And if you look at the numbers, the casualty numbers put out by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, clearly, something well north of 10,000 civilians have died. Those aren't propagandistic numbers, you know? So there's a lot of civilians that have been killed over the last eight, nine years.
I know. I'm not disputing the shelling of Donetsk. I'm not disputing the fact that there's a military conflict there, which for the past 8 years, well, now 9 years, has led to people in that region dying, and that's horrific. You know, what is the alternative? Like, I don't know what the alternative is.
The alternative to what?
And no, allow the area to be annexed.
I'm sorry, the alternative to what?
Well, you know, if you have a foreign country essentially invade one of your provinces, and then that leads to a low-level war over several years, like, yes, it's horrific that people die there. But the only alternative then is to find some sort of peace agreements. But the Minsk Accords fell apart due to different interpretations of what the terms meant. But
well, I'm glad you're not putting all the blame on Russia. At least you're not putting all the blame on Russia. That's progress.
What I'm saying here, and what's the thing I want to zero in on, is that for many Russians who support the war, they have a very, very inaccurate perception of what life is like in Ukraine, politically and culturally. And that misperception
you know better than Russians who have family members living in Luhansk and Donetsk what life is there, what's like there. You know better than them because you've been spending a few years.
I'm not stating that. I'm stating that Russian perceptions of what Ukraine is like, excluding Donetsk and Luhansk, right? Because their support for the war is very much tied to what they perceive, like their perception of Ukraine, right? So from their perspective, they think that Russian speakers are persecuted in Ukraine. They think that Ukraine is rife with Nazis. And that viewpoint has been so drilled into them that when they have family members who are in Ukraine telling them that this is not the truth, they simply refuse to listen. And this is a story that I come across again and again and again of families being torn apart because you have Ukrainians who live in Ukraine who are trying to explain to their families that no, the things you're hearing about Ukraine on Russian television are not accurate. The things that you're hearing about Ukraine on Russian television have no resemblance to reality. And these family members, you know, trust Russian television more than they trust their relatives who are living in Ukraine. It would be like, I don't know, American television saying that Iraq is full of, I don't know, Islamic fundamentalists. And then Iraqis living in the United States believing American television over their relatives who actually live in Iraq.
Basically, that's what happened for the last 20 years. So we've been, you know, from the so-called launch of the war on terror, that's exactly what the U.S. was doing with horrific effect. It was making Americans fear Muslims. It was engaging in extraordinary level of hate mongering against Muslims. And I didn't hear the National Post complaining about that. I have to tell you, I read the National Post quite a bit over that period of time. But let's just put that aside, okay? I will acknowledge... I have no problem acknowledging. I have no problem acknowledging that the Russian government exaggerates the bad in Ukraine and understates the good, and I have no problem acknowledging that skews the attitude of the average Russian towards Ukraine. But I would also say to you, Adam, that's exactly what the West is doing, and that's exactly what Ukraine is doing. Volodymyr Zelensky has basically eliminated the major political parties, shut down the opposition television, opposition newspapers. There is a climate of fear in Ukraine, and if you don't believe me, you should read an article in Politico that was issued, published in the last 2 days, which is one of the most pro-Ukraine organizations in the Western media. Okay, and in it they said... They actually went so far as to quote people who didn't want to go on the record for obvious reasons. They were afraid. Former senior officials in the Ukrainian government saying that there may well be a coup in Ukraine in the months ahead because of the autocratic tendencies of Volodymyr Zelensky and his shady dealings and corruption. Okay, so That government is also, let me finish. That government is also playing that game, and which is what I said at the very outset of this conversation. The propaganda is flying thick and fast on both sides. But what you're doing, I believe, is you're only taking the Russians to task for their propaganda and completely disregarding the tidal wave of propaganda coming out of the elites on our side. I'm trying to sift through all of the propaganda.
Dimitri, I went through that article after I saw it on your Twitter, and I'll be honest, I wish that you would read that article a bit more critically. So one thing you'll notice, for example, is that they claim that Zelensky at one point had only 11% approval rating. And when you click through that, that was completely false, because they basically said, so in the poll, it asks, do you strongly approve, somewhat disapprove, or strongly disapprove? Mm-hmm. So the month they're citing, only 11% of Ukrainians strongly approved, but 38% somewhat approved. So the net approval rating was 49%. But this reporter misrepresented that number and implied that only 11% of Ukrainians approved of Zelensky at that time, when the total number was actually 49%.
You'd identified one mistake. You seem to be acknowledging...
Well, then
there was a lot said in that article, okay? And that was like a little aside, the 11%. It was talking about his autocratic tendencies. He did ban opposition political parties. He did... They even confiscated their assets. They took Medvedchuk and threw him in jail, beat the crap out of him, okay? They have adopted laws which actually put people at risk of expressing. Let's focus on the error you identified. Okay, so let's say it was 49%, and a big part of that was just somewhat approval.
Yeah.
Okay, just somewhat approval. I believe he won the election with 72% on a peace platform. So one thing is clear, even on your numbers, that man suffered a precipitous drop in popular support after the election in a very short period of time. And I talked about this. The number that I quoted, and I found a poll to this effect, I wrote about Zelensky last July when everybody was fawning all over him and pretending that he's some colossus bestriding the world stage. And I pointed out that his popularity rating had fallen at one point to 29%. I didn't say 11. But even on your numbers... He clearly suffered a precipitous decline in popularity. Why did that happen? Why did that happen? You know why? Because he broke his promises. People started to see through him. He was not the servant of the people. He was not an anti-corruption champion. Cy Hirsch, one of the greatest journalists alive today, just published an article citing sources within the U.S. government that the CIA estimates that Zelensky and his entourage have siphoned off at least $400 million from USAID. And this man is a champion of democracy. We're going to trust this man to tell people in Ukraine the truth. Somebody who's just stealing, you know, millions upon millions of dollars from his benefactors.
So one thing I will say is that the approval rating percentage is critical, because the article's argument was that Zelensky was massively unpopular before the war and might easily become massively unpopular after the war. So if you deflate his approval rating by more than 80%, then that's relevant there, right? Like
it's relevant. I grant you that it's relevant, but it doesn't undermine anything that I just said.
And then another piece here. So if you would, and so I pointed this out here, is that if you click through on the article where it says that he has autocratic tendencies, that article provides no evidence in support of that aside from a few quotes from a few opposition parliamentarians.
I just gave you the evidence. And so he shut down opposition parties. He banned opposition parties. How is that not autocratic?
No. So I will deal with that in a second. So, you know, someone that doesn't have autocratic tendencies just because some opposition parliamentarians say they do. If you were to use that line of argument, you could, for example, say that, Biden has autocratic tendencies because of this article where we quote a few Republicans saying that he's a dictator. It doesn't work that way. You need to have more robust evidence to make that kind of claim. So this idea that he has autocratic tendencies because a few opposition parliamentarians have claimed that, you know, that's just not enough to make that kind of argument.
What now, opposition parliamentarians? Is there even a serious opposition anymore? He banned the real opposition. What opposition?
He banned a small collection of pro-Russian parties.
He banned the largest opposition party in Ukraine's parliament, Adam. It was the largest opposition party. And you know what? If Putin went and banned, just ask. I want to ask you this: if Putin went and banned the largest opposition party in the Duma on the basis that it was pro-Ukraine, what would you say? You'd say, "Oh, that tyrant Putin, using excuses to shut down dissent." But when Zelensky does it, oh, he uses the magic word pro-Russia. In Ukraine, there are people, millions of them, who actually are pro-Russian, okay? And it's not surprising, and it's not a crime. It shouldn't be a crime to be pro-Russian when you yourself, you're ethnically Russian, you worship in the Russian Orthodox Church, you speak Russian, you have family in Russia. It shouldn't be a crime, it shouldn't be a sin to be pro-Russian, okay? And it's no surprise, therefore, that you will have, in a democratic society with a significant component of the population like that, having that ethnic and linguistic makeup, that want to have good relations with Russia. That's not a crime. And of course, that they're going to want to have political representation in parliament. Of course they will. So how does this constitute a legitimate excuse for shutting down those parties, the fact that they're pro-Russian? These are simply political parties which were given expression to the will of a significant segment of the Ukrainian population that naturally and inevitably has an affinity towards Russia. That is not a legitimate excuse for banning them, Adam. You're making up excuses. And if, as I said, if Putin did this using the same excuse, you would not hesitate to condemn him and call him a tyrant.
Look, the size of these parties was small. And the largest party, which was banned, was Opposition for Life, which had about 44 seats out of 450. which was run by Medvedev, who, from my understanding, directly receives funding from Putin through a shady oil deal. It's been a few months since I wrote the article on this.
According to whom? What's your sources? I mean, if you can tell me. If you can't tell me your sources, fine, but then I'm really in no position to judge.
I'm sure we could talk for hours about all of this. Let's switch to the Green Party. Sure. So my question for you is, how do you see your current trip in the context of Green Party politics?
I'm going to be as candid with you as I've been from the very outset, okay? I think that my coming here and my taking the position that I've taken. And by the way, I just have to stop and clarify one thing, because I'm kind of sick and tired of people misrepresenting my position. My position about this war is that we should provide robust humanitarian support to the Ukrainian people. We should provide robust support to refugees from Ukraine, whether they're coming from the Russian-controlled areas or the Ukrainian-controlled areas. We should not be sending weapons to anybody in this conflict. We should stay out of the military aspects of it altogether, and we should do everything we can to facilitate a dialogue and a negotiation. So that's my position, and my position, by the way, is the dominant position of governments outside of the West. For example, what I've just said is exactly the position of Latin America. This is the position of the Mexican government, the position of the Brazilian government. You can go on and on. So in the West, my position, and this, I'm getting to your question. My position, unfortunately, in the West is wildly unpopular, and I'm well aware of that. And I was well aware of that when I started speaking out last February, because I was concerned about my children being incinerated in a nuclear war. So I think basically, I think I would have had an excellent chance of winning the leadership of the Green Party of Canada if I'd run before this war began. I think by coming here and by advocating for the things I've advocated for, my political prospects in the Green Party lie in smoking ruins. And I was fully aware that that is a price I was going to pay by doing this. So if you're wondering whether I think that this is somehow enhancing my political prospects, I can assure you that nothing could be further from the truth.
I noticed that you had retweeted Jonathan, his video about him in Ukraine.
Yes.
Let me pull it up. You were critical of his trip to Ukraine,
nope.
I believe.
Nope. I asked a question.
No. Okay, sorry.
I actually commended him. But then I asked a question. And I didn't get an answer to my question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So my question to you is, what do you think concretely will happen if the West stops providing weapons to Ukraine?
I think that Zelensky will be forced to sit down at a table and he'll have to negotiate and he's going to have to make territorial concessions. And frankly, okay. I think at this stage, that's the best thing. I think that I will put it this way. It is the least undesirable outcome. The idea, I think it would be absolutely horrifying. I do believe that this is the case for most people who live in Luhansk and Donetsk and in Crimea. After all the bloodletting and the savagery and the death and the destruction, those people do not want to live under the rule of the government in Kiev. They simply don't. Not now and not for the foreseeable future. And frankly, I share their concern. I think that if the Ukrainian forces managed to retake those areas, there would be retribution on a massive scale for anybody who cooperated with the Russian forces. And if we actually care about minimizing death, it probably is a good thing at this stage, or it's the least undesirable thing that there be some kind of a partition which allows Ukraine to keep Odessa, to keep a Black Sea coast, not to become landlocked, to keep a sizable chunk of its territory east of the Dnieper, and that the killing stop. And I think that Russia should pay massive amounts of money to help reconstruct Ukraine. I think Ukraine should stay there. And one other thing, Ukraine should stay the hell out of NATO. It should never have gone down that path to begin with. I think that that's the least awful outcome.
Okay, so my question is, would you support a territorial deal that would bring things back to its pre-2022 borders? So, for example, giving back Zaporizhia, giving back most of Kherson Oblast.
My friend, this has nothing to do with what I want. I'm talking about what I think is realistically achievable. Okay, I just want peace. That's all I want. Where they draw the borders.
Do you think that Russia will stay?
Okay, that's the question you should be asking me. And I think that's a pipe dream now. Yeah. I think that's a pipe dream. I think that back in March, I think back in March, that was a deal that was eminently doable. I think that Zelensky should have taken that deal. I think there's good reason to believe that the Americans and the British stuck their nose in the negotiations and effectively sabotaged them. There's lots of reason to believe that happened, although I don't profess to know exactly why that deal didn't ultimately get concretized. But I think it's pretty clear now. Again, this is not what I want. I think it's pretty clear now that deal just isn't on the table anymore.
Well, so my question is, if there were to be a peace deal, do you believe that Russia would not engage in further expansionary wars going forward?
No. I think there's absolutely no reason to believe that, and that's just a pile of malarkey. That is being inculcated in the West so that we will continue pumping weapons into Ukraine. If people actually formed the opinion, which I have, and I could be wrong, Adam, I could be wrong. You know, I can't read Vladimir Putin's mind. All I can do is make a judgment based upon his actions and his words. My read of the man is that he doesn't want this war to continue. My read of the man is he wants, you know, certain minimum things, and if he gets them, he'll stop, and that's the end of it.
Okay, so my question here is that, for example, you've cited, you know, Latin American countries, you've cited your own assessment of this. Eastern European leaders and Eastern European citizens seem to strongly believe that Russia will continue to engage in expansionary wars if there is a peace deal, that Russia's goal is to reestablish its hegemony in the region. Do you think that these people's opinions deserve to be listened to, considering that Eastern Europeans have, they are the historical colonial victims of Russian aggression? Do you believe that the the historical victims of Russian colonialism should be listened to more than anyone else when it comes to assessing Russia's risk to the region.
Well, I would never advocate for anybody's voice to be silenced. I'm sure, you know, knock yourselves out, make your case, okay? But I'll come back at you with this, and I say this from the bottom of my heart. Ain't no Eastern European leader going to put my children's future at risk. I don't give a good goddamn what delusions they suffer from. But those people, especially the Polish government, the way they're behaving in the Baltic states, they're going to get us all killed. They're going to get us all killed. I'm not going to defer when we're talking about the survival of humanity. I'm not going to just replace my own judgment with theirs. I understand that they have historical trauma, which is affecting their ability to be objective. But at the end of the day, we got to do what's necessary to preserve life on this planet. And I just think they're wrong. Fundamentally wrong. And at the end of the day, you guys need to be asking yourselves, those of you who disagree with me on this, where is this going to end if we continue down the path the West is going? That's the real question. Because where we're heading, in my opinion, is, as I said at the outset, either in the least worst case scenario, the destruction of Ukraine, and probably the loss, if not the complete annihilation of the nation of Ukraine, very likely the loss of a Black Sea coast, a little rump state that is going to be suffering for decades to come, lying in smoking ruins. And don't think for one second, Adam, that the Americans are going to continue pumping money in there. They will abandon Ukraine as soon as Ukraine ceases to serve their geopolitical agenda, just as they abandon Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Vietnam, and on and on. They will not continue to support Ukraine. That's what's going to happen in the least worst case scenario. In the worst case scenario, we're all dead.
What I will say is that the general opinion in Eastern Europe and in Ukraine is that if Putin is allowed to walk away with a territorial victory, then that will encourage him to engage in more war in the future. No one wants to create World War III. Eastern European states are very aware that they would be the first, that they would suffer the most.
They have something that Ukraine doesn't have. They have an Article 5 guarantee. They're members of NATO. They're members of NATO. There's really no rational reason to think that Vladimir Putin is going to attack a NATO country. For God's sakes, we have been pumping weapons into that theater of war, providing real-time battlefield intelligence to the Ukrainians to kill Russians. We've got members, former members of our military over there, former special forces, former army rangers fighting on the front line with our knowledge and approval, and still they haven't attacked a NATO country. They still haven't launched
because they an attacker.
Why would you think?
Yeah, because they have to get quality control over Ukraine first. They're not going to attack the Baltics until they get control over Ukraine.
According to the accounts, this is one of the paradoxes of Western media coverage. According to the accounts of Western media, Russia's military has taken an absolute beating. Absolute beating. And it's lost far more soldiers than the Ukrainians. Let's assume that that's true. Don't you think that, you know, if this partition happens along the lines that I've suggested would be doable, it's my best guess, that afterwards Putin and his government are going to look at that and say, man, that was painful. Imagine how much worse it's going to be if we attack a NATO country. I mean, do you actually think he's insane? I don't. I listen to the man's speeches. A lot of what he says I disagree with. Some of what he says makes sense. But one thing is for damn sure, that man is not insane. And I think he would be insane to attack after the beating that Russia has suffered thus far. He would be insane to attack a NATO country.
So first of all, I think that it'd be very likely that if he were allowed to keep land, that he would attack in the future. And there's two reasons for that. So the first reason is that Ukraine was incredibly lucky this year that the Russian leaders were not aware of how decrepit their own military was, right? Like, Ukraine was very lucky in that Russia wasn't aware of how thoroughly corruption had hollowed out the Russian military. And I guess to a certain degree that they were lucky that the Russians had underestimated the level of Ukrainian resistance that they would face. So I think that the Russians would be very aware that their next attack would be much better prepared. So I don't think the Ukraine is going to get lucky twice. The second piece is that, you know, Western power is waning. And I think that the Russians are very aware of that. and that it would be reasonable for them to want to conquer Ukraine or launch another attack, another expansion, another war in maybe 5, 6, 7 years if they're allowed to keep their territory, right?
Yeah, well,
it shows that they can launch an attack, they can, you know, lose 100, 200, 300,000 soldiers, but they'll get land out of it. And that exchange is worth it for them. Like, mm-hmm.
Well, I would point out to you, Adam, that I hear you, and I again, this is the arguments you're making are ones that are standard in the West when people talk about whether or not we should continue pumping weapons into this existentially dangerous war. And I would suggest to you that the reason why the West is becoming weak, and there's no doubt it is precisely because of this war. Its arsenals are being depleted. The Europeans have lost access to cheap gas. They're being deindustrialized. They're now dependent upon more polluting, much more costly frack gas from the United States. People are getting very upset about their energy bills. The U.S. and the Western countries over the past several decades have lost the industrial capacity to keep up with Russia and China. So if this continues, what is going to happen is your worst nightmare, which is that the West is going to become incredibly weak. If you want to deter Russia, in my opinion, from attacking a NATO state, I think the way to do that is by remaining strong. And continuing this war is not going to accomplish that. It's going to undermine the strength of the West.
Mm. Okay, let's leave it at that. You know, I'm sure we could discuss this for hours afterwards. Obviously, we have very, very strong disagreements on key aspects of this conflict. I will try to represent your ideas as fairly as possible. And feel free to publish this interview.
I'll wait to see what you, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. And by the way, Adam, I hope you don't take this personally. It's not that I think you're incapable of writing a balanced article. It's just I have absolutely no confidence in your media organization. They've been savaging my reputation for years. They've been dragging my name through the mud 1-6 ways from Sunday. So I would be astonished if your editor or editors would allow you to, even if you were minded to do so, write an article which fairly presented my views on these matters. I'll be astonished, but you know, I hope I'm pleasantly surprised.
Look, okay, so what I'll say here, and you know, a bit more informally, is that I have been a little bit disappointed in the pieces that you've written because they're not as, how should I say, this could sound really condescending or offensive, but like thoughtful as I had hoped they would be. So for example, let's talk about your article on Crimea recently. So personally, I'm agnostic about Crimea. It's a much more complicated issue than many Western writers would like to admit or are aware of. However, you know, what I noticed in your article, which I think could be improved, is that when you were talking about the level of support for joining Russia in 2014, you had cited the referendum, which showed 97% support. And those referendums are not, Russia's referendums are not accurate representations of people's opinions or beliefs. However, there was polling data which came out before that, which showed that approximately 35 to 40% of Crimeans before the war wanted to join Russia. Now, that's a significant sum, and that's a sum that many Westerners aren't aware of. But then that opens up a very different and complicated conversation about how do you deal with a society which is somewhat evenly split about which country it wants to go to. And by misrepresenting the referendum as being accurate.
I didn't do that.
As saying that,
you're misrepresenting what I wrote. I said reportedly. I said the referendum reportedly showed a result of this, and there was reportedly. I didn't say it was accurate. Where in my article did I say it was accurate? And by the way, I'd like to see this poll. When was this poll taken, by the way? Exactly. When was the exact point in time when it was taken?
February 2014, I believe, or January 2014. I'll send you the article. And so, you know, when you look at polling in Ukraine in terms of support for Russia, so what you see is that the majority of Ukrainians supported open borders with Russia up until about 2014. And there was about 20% of people supported joining Russia. Then after 2014, that number dips, and the number of people who want to join Russia goes down to about 5 to 7%. And then you have an even split with the remaining Ukrainians, with half of them saying that they want open borders with Russia and some sort of close relationship. Mm-hmm. And the other half saying that they want to have a relationship with Russia as they would with any other country. So just normal borders, potentially, you know, visas, all of that.
Yeah.
Then, of course, then the most full-scale invasion happens, and any support for any special relationship with Russia dissipates. Because, you know, it turns out that when you invade a country, the residents of that country really don't like you. but when you look at levels of support for joining Russia, at its highest was in Crimea at approximately 40%. Donetsk was approximately 33%. Odessa at its height was approximately 24%. So these are significant portions of the population, but they're not as high as Russia would want you to believe. Russia wants you to believe that the majority of these residents, you know, are secretly yearning to join with Russia, which really wasn't the case.
Yeah,
well, most of the support was for you to remain a sovereign nation,
right,
with perhaps like open borders.
Well, I tell you so, why this is all very interesting. I look forward to receiving this polling data from you. I will certainly take it into account. But there's a reason why I asked you at what point precisely that poll you're citing about Crimea was taken, is because I wouldn't at all be surprised at all if that was the sentiment before Yanukovych was replaced by that government in Kiev. Okay, that was a probably had a major impact on public opinion in Crimea about joining Russia. I suspect, you know, it's one thing to ask a person from Crimea, how do you feel about remaining in Ukraine when your vote counts? You're a Russian speaker, you want to have good relations with Russia and your vote counts. Your guy won the election, it was fairly contested, and he tried to have good relations with Russia. Asking them that question and then asking them the question after what they view as a far-right coup of people who are Russophobic, depriving them of their vote, that's likely going to affect attitudes quite a bit. So I think it's very important to look at the exact point in time at which that poll was taken. But I will look at it. I'm very interested to see it.
Fair. And then the second piece, which I think is an important thing that needs to be mentioned whenever we talk about current sentiments in Crimea, is population change since the annexation, right? So Crimea's population is approximately 1.9 million, 2 million. And of that population, 800,000 people immigrated from Russia over the past, well, since 2014, right? Yep. So you're looking at approximately 40% of the population are new migrants from Russia. Some may see that as a form of colonization. There's different ways to interpret it. But the question is,
I think that's a very fair point making. I think that's a very fair point. Absolutely. There was obviously an exodus of people who were pro-Ukraine.
Well, the thing is, it's not as much as you would think. So the exodus is only about 1,140,000. It's more about the influx here. So some of the pro-Ukrainian voices will mention the exodus without putting it into proper context, right? And they'll say, oh, mass exodus of pro-Ukrainians. That number was only about, let's say, 10 to 15% of the population. But now you have this influx of 800,000 people, and then they affect the overall public opinion in Crimea. And then you have to wonder, okay, what is their role in determining Crimea's future as recent migrants from Russia who could be perceived as colonial agents, right?
Yep.
And there's also, you know, one thing that I think that you and I can agree upon is that there's not enough discourse about what happens with those 800,000 people if that, you know, if Crimea is retaken by the Ukrainians.
Yeah,
is that fair?
I think question, but I think it's purely hypothetical, because the reality is they ain't retaking Crimea. That's just the reality.
Yeah, but it's an important thing when people say, well, you know, retaking Crimea. I've actually had some conversation with that was like, okay, you want to retake Crimea. Well, what do you do with those 800,000 Russian migrants? But I say this as someone who like tends to look at those quote unquote unpopular populations. So for example, you know, I studied East Asian studies for my undergrad. And one thing that always struck me was, you know, Japanese colonists in Korea, about 1 million of them were expelled after Japan lost World War II. And then you think, well, okay, you know, you have a colonizing force, but the ethics get really tricky when you figure out, okay, well, what do you do with, you know, average civilians who might have moved for economic reasons, all of that. Anyways, right. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, that population is very, very tricky for both pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian voices when it comes to Crimea and figuring out what Crimea's future is.
Right. I understand.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll send you some of that. If you're interested, I can send you some work, some other work that I've done, just to give you.
Please do. Please do.
Maybe a. Okay.
I'm always open, and you know, I appreciate the fact, as strongly as we disagree, that this has been a respectful, civil conversation. We both approached it in a manner that these conversations should be approached, as spirited as the debate was. And unfortunately, Adam, it's really hard to have this kind of debate when you're dealing with this issue in our country nowadays. Really hard.
What I will say, if you're ever open to it, and, you know, assuming you don't get banned because of your previous commentary, if you do ever want to visit Ukraine, I'm happy to connect you with civil society organizations and voices, whether it be, for example, racialized Ukrainians, LGBTQ Ukrainians, Jewish Ukrainians, humanitarian aid workers, anyone you want to meet, you know, in Ukraine. If I can find a way to help you meet those people, I'm glad to provide assistance. We may not agree politically, but that's precisely why I would want to make those introductions.
You know, I would be more than happy to meet the people you've described. In fact, I'd love to come to Odessa. I thought very seriously about trying to do that, but I'll be blunt with you. I don't feel safe. I don't feel safe coming to Ukraine right okay. now. And I didn't feel safe before I came to Russia. So based on what I was reading and given the things I had been saying publicly and the way I was getting attacked by pro-Ukrainian people in Canada, I was, at the end of the day, I decided not to go to Odessa because I felt it was just too risky. But, you know, if the situation okay. evolves where I don't have that fear, I would love to talk to people and come to Ukraine and see with my own eyes.
Well, if you ever want to do Zoom interviews or phone calls, I'm happy to facilitate those for you.
Sure, I would. Yeah, anytime. Okay. You let me know.
Okay, great. Okay, so I'm going to call it a night. Okay. I hope that you stay safe.
You too, man. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.